Please take seat. We will start our work in a few seconds. This morning, until the coffee break, we will have I will have to correct a little bit the number of presentations. The first presentation will be given anyway by Professor Ferenc Meze in our question. Afterwards, it was on the agenda, Professor Viktor Lazarevich Aksionov, his contribution with the DNS4 project, present status and trends. Unfortunately, Viktor Lazarevich got sick, so we all wish him a speedy recovery, but he won't be able to deliver his presentation here. So as a last minute measure, we decided that instead of this presentation, there will be two short presentations. The first given by Professor Balagurov, Anatoly Balagurov, and the second by Sasha Joffe, who is anyway the chair of the working subgroup. And afterwards, we will have three scientific reports as originally envisaged and followed by the coffee break, including the poster presentation by young scientists. So the first speaker will be Professor Ferenc Mezei, who was, as an external expert, invited here to the PAC meeting, both to the PAC meeting and to the working group meeting before. I don't think it's necessary to introduce Ferry, as we all call him, really very much. But nevertheless, I think just a few words for those who may not have heard about all his achievements. First, he became, I think, really worldwide famous by the neutron spin idea. I remember I was part of his very first seminar in Budapest when he appeared in the meeting room showing that the first successful feasibility experiment. That was, I think, for it was 72. Am I right? Or 71? 72, yeah, okay. And then just very briefly, Mezei 4pi experiment, Mezei supermirrors. Supermirrors are nowadays just mentioned as supermirrors, but it was Ferry's invention, and now I will stop because he should present us his ideas. So Ferry, it's your turn, and you will speak about the instrumentation and moderators at long pulse neutron sources, of course, with impact of our project, the new GINAR neutron source. So, Ferry, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about work, actually a lot of experimental results in the direction of using the available amount of neutrons better, more efficiently, which then led to this long pulse idea, long pulse notion. Actually, logically, I should start by defining what are long pulses and what are short pulses. That will be the conclusion. First, we go through what kind of long pulse work was done by now. Now, to start with, hope it works. Ah, maybe it's this one. Which one? I can do it with this. That's fine with me. Like which one?
This way? The other, upside down.
Okay. So, when we talk about neutrons, the fundamental thing not to be forgotten that neutrons are expensive. There are many of them, but there have been a lot of energy to get them out of the nuclei, and that costs energy, and energy is money. So basically, that is just a reminder how many neutrons we get for a joule of heat deposited. There are different methods with somewhat different efficiencies in the same range. And this leads to that the energy we need to produce the neutrons in the top neutron facilities today is already a substantial part of the operational costs, and I don't think we will ever have neutron sources for research which produce more fast neutrons at the beginning. Progress is only use the neutrons which are produced more efficiently. And if we look at something like the ILL situation, about 1 million, from 1 million created neutrons, which cost money and heat, and thermodynamic is even worse than capitalism, hard to get through. Actually, about 1 in 1 million has a chance to appear in a beamline. So that's the whole talk is about how to get in, maybe not one by ten, but 10 out of 1 million at the end. Now, part of the wasting of the neutrons we produce, dearly produce, is that the neutrons come via fast neutrons, they have to be slowed down, and then they're slowed down to some kind of Maxwellian spectrum. This was expected for ESS, the total number of cold neutrons, which is comparable to ILL. Actually, the ILL official line, this is a Maxwellian, this is not a Maxwellian, and we know by now it's wrong. So the two are about the same. But all these neutrons come with a broad distribution of velocity or wavelengths or energy. So, and when we do neutron scattering experiments, then we need monochromatic beam. We need to know the velocity, know the wavelengths. So it means we throw out everything else and we only keep that much. That's kind of the normal way to operate on a continuous source. Now, some experiments which are just irradiation, for example, we want to activate something, then we can use the whole band. But that's another game. We are talking about neutron scattering, where we need to know the parameter, the wavelengths of the neutron with some precision. Doesn't have to be very good, but with some precision. Now, that is about the curve I showed. It's not very monochromatic, but say if we would do some cold neutron diffraction work, we would monochromatize the beam like that. If we do small angle scattering work, then we would get up about that much. And that will be the band we would use from all these neutrons. And here, pulse neutrons make a fundamental difference. And I don't have to remind you, I used to remind people at other places, that this started here in Dubna. That is, if we go over, instead of a continuous source, to a pulse source, then the fraction of the spectrum we can use, it depends from the time between pulses, and then we will not use just one wavelength, but a band of wavelengths, which all, for every second, every minute of the time, every moment of the time, each of the neutrons, which arrive, will have velocities known with this precision. But with taking this sacrifice, instead of having one wavelength, having a number as a function of time up to the next pulse, we just know from each of them, either with this precision or much better precision, we know the velocity. So we get the situation that the efficiency of the using the produced spectrum for the pulse sources will not depend. The band we can use not depend of the required monochromaticity of the beam, but will actually depend mostly distances and the frequency of the pulse, how much time we have between two pulses to allow neutrons with different velocity arrive one after the other. Now, if we lower the repetition rate of the source, that we have more time between pulses, for example, go to about one third, we will be able to pick up 3 times more neutrons from the spectrum. So that source, this yellow source, is a lot more efficient in using the produced neutrons than the higher rep rate source, and of course a lot more efficient than a continuous source, which throws out all the neutrons we don't need. And if we have good velocity resolution, then we can throw out unnecessarily or eventually avoidably something like 100 times more than necessary. The important reminder from here that in neutron scattering applications, some uses like Spinnaker or SANS already uses a decent fraction of the total spectrum. So the way to do better than this, or essentially better, is to have low rep rate sources and use a large part of the band. For example, here, that's very realistic for a SANS machine, we use 6 angstrom wavelength band. But if you would use just 1 angstrom high rep rate, the gain would be, it would recover fewer neutrons. Now, these ideas came up early. Actually, just remind you that actually ESS work started in 1992. By the time it will be in operation, it's 30 years later. So the young people who started it will be nearly retired, or retired like myself. But at the beginning, it turned out that the objective of having strong single pulses, 100 kilojoule per pulse, which is about 5 times SNS, was not really realistic. And the idea of long pulses came up in 1993, just by the fact that we cannot deposit 100 kilojoules in short pulses. That is, with the goal to keep the intensity, the number of neutrons in a pulse growing up compared to the previous facilities. And in 2006, when S3 call appeared for building ESS, the short pulse original short pulse option disappeared for the simple reason it's not doable. Actually, it's not doable today with the same parameter. 100 kilojoule per pulse is beyond what we can do in short pulses. In long pulses, can be a lot more. So that was the origin of the story. The reason short pulses got to a technical limit that because of details that of accelerator details that the short pulses at the end will be produced by emptying a ring, a storage ring. 1 microsecond is the invariable pulse length due to the velocity of light. And even at ESS, at SNS, many years ago, for the time the neutron pulse hits the target, for that is just 1 microsecond. We have in 2 liter volume 17 times that power. The Niagara force is the unit in energy, is in that sense. It's 1 gigavolt instantaneous. Now, so that technological limit was the main reason to thinking about other ways to proceed. And it turned out that it's not so complicated, because if we remove parts of the SNS accelerator, for example, the storage ring, we can make a lot of things simpler, just have a linear accelerator. Spend some more money on the linear accelerator, what we saved on the ring. Then, 100 microseconds, the linear accelerator will deliver the same kilojoule, same energy per pulse. Then you get from the basic the design as it was built. The only difference will be, and this is a kind of the key of the matter, that the 1 microsecond short pulses in high energy neutrons. For cold neutron, it means 300 microseconds, because the slowing down time is not zero. And that is what's shown here. The dashed line would be a cold neutron pulse at SNS. It is something like that. And if we add if we go over to 100 microseconds, somewhat more powerful linear accelerator, and stop it after 1 microsecond, we can reproduce the same. Would be about the same cost, but the operational cost would be still much less. Then the next idea is just that, since we know that is something like a few hundred microseconds for the slowing down time, if we don't switch off the linear accelerator after 100 microseconds, it will climb up to something like that. Now, that pulse is a multiple in the peak and a big multiple in the intensity per pulse. For example, small angle scattering, you use the whole pulse, it's a huge factor. And there are ways, simply mechanical choppers, which would cut out of this pulse, according to our wish, the pulse lengths we will need for the various experiments. For example, there is another one. And as a matter of fact, then actually, the bottom line is the bottom line. How much it costs? What can we afford? If you want to have high peak flux, forget about short pulses for a given amount of money. If you have infinite money, if you can make infinite the short pulse infinite high, that's in principle. But for the same costs, that thing is just doing nothing good, shortening the incoming proton pulse. Just you have to defer the function to the neutron technology, and cutting neutron pulses shorter, we know very well. For example, this one shows a chopper very close to the face of the spallation source monolith at G-Park. And once you have these choppers, then you don't have to worry so much about creating the short pulse by, not that short pulse actually, by the fast neutron, shortening the fast neutron pulse. Now, that was one point for saving, using the neutrons more efficiently. The second is this. Time-of-flight spectroscopy, that is type of applications when we need monochromatic beams coming to the sample and still in pulses, so that we can analyze the velocity after the sample. If we would use just one pulse from each source pulse, I mentioned above, we want the source rep rate relatively low, so that we can have powerful pulses. Otherwise, you just distribute the same energy on many pulses. Then you would have a lot of dead time. This is what most short pulse machines do, actually. by now less, but did for a very long time. If we now allow ourselves for the complexity that we don't work just with one single wavelength, but allow other wavelengths coming out and creating pulses at the sample with a much higher frequency than the source, basically we use one source pulse several times, then we can fill in the dead time, and that's kind of again what you have no sacrifices. On the other end, the little sacrifices that instead of having one data set, you have five. Thinking and computing is better, more economic than the neutron producing more neutrons. Now, we started in the around 2000, before 2000, to develop such an instrument for the short pulse neutron source at Los Alamos. That's a simulation. It never got ready. In the meantime, Lujan Center was shut down. That with a 20 hertz pulse rate on the source could easily collect data at 240 hertz on the sample. And that just shows a simulated spectra on something like when we assume that we want to look at the width of this quasi-elastic line, like studying diffusion. And this could be emulated on the time-of-flight machine in Berlin, which is a continuous reactor, which shows that indeed after time we get a sequence of pulses from 3 angstroms and 13 angstrom in this case, and if you look at the information in the spectrum, which is partly the line widths of the quasi-elastic line and the inelastic spectrum around it, it still contains, each of them contains useful information. Of course, if the wavelength band is much too big, we would have 1 angstrom, then not all of it would be useful. But this multiplication works pretty well up to decent wavelength bands. And then there are kind of technical development which have been done. For example, if you want to chop neutron beams with different wavelengths, and you either have to have a disk chopper, which is a funny disk chopper here, or if you want to have short times, then we need to have a broadband Fermi chopper, which is something like that. That is, the neutrons go in this direction, so they are short in the direction of the neutrons, and we can get a decent broadband. The other thing is that if you have a broad distribution of wavelengths in the multiplied spectrum, you see here the scattered data take shorter times to come. That is, the time frame you have to observe is shorter. So the optimal use would be that we have not equal distribution in time between the many pulses on the source, on the sample, but it gets slower as the pulse, as the neutron wavelength gets longer. And for example, this is a way to use it. Jülich built a chopper, which is a lot more more complicated but more flexible to use it anyway, that this rotates with the source. At the beginning, we have for the first 3 pulses at short wavelengths, they come with the natural frequency of the chopper that creates the short pulses, and then we suppress every second, and here we let through one in three, so that just makes it more efficient for broadband application. And now if you have a broadband application, that matters, because if the rep rate is low at a certain distance, you get between pauses a broader minimum and maximum wavelengths. So broadband is synonym of low rep rate. Broadband in the data collection. And actually the method has been used in real experiment at JPARC in 2009 on an instrument which wasn't built for that. Since then they are full time. This is the way they operate. And here what they had a Fermi chopper which had a transmission band like that, so they could select a number of pulses coming from one source pulse, then could select about four pulses on the sample and look at, for example, this shows a magnon study. With short wavelengths, you see the broad picture. Here with longer wavelengths, you get in the same set of data much better resolution information. So that it confirmed that the thing works and you get useful data with the various wavelengths. Now the other aspect is not spectroscopy. That is, we want a non-monochromatic beam on the sample, but we should know not a single wavelength, but we should know what is the wavelength. And this is time of flight, using time of flight for diffraction. That was a time of flight machine built in Budapest long time ago, again, more than 20 years. And here we have a continuous source. We have a chopper here which produces pulses from time to time. And then at the detector, we get a wavelength band from something like 1 to 5 angstrom, which you cover and for the diffraction work, pretty much as you do here at IBR. Now, this chopper system was on a continuous source, and we did not have any background from the continuous source which was on, because the first chopper made sure that the non-neutrons could come through before the next opening. So we could use the chopper to turn very efficiently a continuous source into a pulse source with little background between pulses. Now, sorry. This is a kind of trickier case to use to monochromatize, because the chopper is at some distance, cannot be at the inside the source, so the chopper is outside. They can produce sharp pulses. And what we have to make sure that they don't mix. That is, if a neutron came through in a, I don't know, it's a 50 microsecond pulse here, when it hits the sample, it hits the detector, we should know for sure that it comes from here and not from the next. And that can be achieved by setting up with other choppers an effective wall between these subframes, or rep rate multiplication frames, so that they don't mix. And that we could also deal experimentally on this time of flight chopper, time of flight machine, time of flight diffractometer in Budapest. It shows in real dimensions, but somewhere we had a fast chopper which produced the definition of the pulse lengths. Then the other two choppers were phased. They were not built for that, but fortunately could be phased like that, that they keep these, only take neutrons from one pulse at a time. That is, if we are here at the detector, we know that it had to come through this pulse and couldn't be come from here, or couldn't be come from later, because there we can put a band chopper which helps us. And actually this example shows that the chopper system is clear. In that case, it was a pulse source experiment, but the pulse was defined by the choppers as looking back to the source. It's a virtual pulse. The chopper system only looks for neutrons for a given time. And now this helps to understand, which I will come back to this, the definition of the long pulse, because long pulse is a pulse which a chopper system can define that this is the time when I look, and for the rest I don't, which is a huge gain, for example, of a reactor, a huge gain in efficiency, because I set up all my choppers such that they only look for neutrons. They work all the time. They get neutrons all the time. So every source pulse is used 10, 20, 50 times. That's the multiplication. But they only look for neutrons at a given time to the source and don't and actually block all the rest. So the, in the rest, I can do whatever I want with the source, leave it on, have a lot of background, or switch it off. And if I switch off, we save the gain in efficiency. That means we can afford higher flux because we don't have to deliver the money and the heat for all the time, just for this time. When the instruments ask for neutrons. And they did experiments how to test it. So this is put in some sample. Now it shows the data collection at the detector. At the detector as a function of time. That gives you a diffraction pattern, something like that, which is actually just one, but the starting time for this, this, and that is different. So if we now try to plot the same data, not as a function of the detection time, but the flight time, because for this we know when they started, that's the next pulse, and so on, then we get the perfect diffraction pattern. Now, there's a simple trick here, which was people talked about a lot, but I think by now only we are the only one who tested it, and is running the source and the choppers asynchronously, shifting, phase throughing it, it says. And in that case, you don't have to, because if I go back, when you, for example, this is already also appears here, and then you have to fuse it, you have some irregularity in the monitor rate. That is how much exposure you had, and that is shown here. That if you have a monitor, you see that the spectrum is put together from three frames. That is the first one. Here is a little bump. The second, and the third was somewhere here. If you have the asynchronous operation, just random phase, then it all disappears because every part of the spectrum is used identically. So, and if you do that, you can have very nice shape pulses and variable resolution. So we just can forget about it. If the pulse length, the source pulse appears in data that in your data, that's always complication. Now, this has also been implemented for use. Actually, one of the very successful instruments at JPARC is the backscattering machine, where they use the same wavelength frame monochromatization system. And it is on a short pulse source. So I come back at the end to say more about it. But it's a short pulse source. They had the choice between, for this high resolution application, between taking a coupled moderator pulse, which is that long, treat it as a long pulse, cut it into short pulses. Actually, they have something like 20 microseconds. Or try to poison the moderators, and you can get this microscopic whatever. I mean, a much less neutron in the peak, and a line shape which is not optimal for good resolution, this asymmetric line shape. So JPARC had the courage and intelligence to let them convince that if they want to have really good resolution, they shouldn't go for the short pulse approach, but take the most intense pulse, the best, most efficient monitor, and cut it. Do this with wavelength stream multiplication. The machine is real fun. I made one experiment and it works perfectly. Now another way, another chapter, we can improve the use efficiency of the neutrons if we combine two spectra in the same guide. So for that shows the Berlin reactor. Here we have a cold source, and next to it we have the beryllium, which serves effectively as thermal source. So again, many years ago, we built a bispectral beam extraction for this case. That means we have a super mirror switch. For short wavelengths neutrons, this super mirror is transparent. So for the guide, for short wavelengths neutrons, the neutrons come from here. For longer wavelengths, this would kick out the neutrons from this side, and from the other side will be reflected into the beam. And instead of something like that, which we had previously in Berlin, this is measured spectra, we went over to this, this black one, with and as a matter of fact, if you correct it for the transmission efficiency of the guide, the spectra which was picked up at the guide of the beginning, it was something like that. The dashed line is the corrected. So that's another factor of two in most applications. And then coming to the last one, how you pick the moderators. Now the usual thing was, idea was to have a moderator is big enough that it delivers a divergent beam. You'll see that we can do better than that. And then at the design work at ESS, we realized that if you look in detail, the conventional size that was a volume moderator, what the JPARC used, which was better than the previous ones, the intensity is strong at the walls and little in the middle. So that idea, good, then throughout the middle. So by making this, this was a cylindrical moderator, something like you see here, I don't know, 10 centimeter high, going down, actually the optimum was 100 centimeter high, the intensity went from here to here. And if you look at the spectrum, the brightness of the surface of the moderator, if it's big, 10 centimeter high, you have this curve. If it's 1.5 centimeter high, you have that curve. So you have a lot more neutrons per square centimeter. Now that was the model which JPARC introduced, which is already better, but that had been before, parahydrogen. And actually the JPARC people noticed in their calculations in 2004 that the edges are more intense, but did not made use of it in the design. And that is actually much later an experiment between ESS and JPARC people on the JPARC moderator to really check this one, how it looks, and I found that the effect exists. Actually, one of the reasons was that JPARC at the end decided not to use this high intensity because they were afraid of the background fast neutrons from the edges, from the walls of the moderator. We'll come back to that. And then if you do systematically, just sort of the summary, if you use conventional moderator, which people used before the, I will show the geometry, before the JPARC innovation of the volume moderator, you get something like that as a brightness, as a function of position. The volume moderator of G-Park was already better. And if we now reduce the height, you go up a good factor. There is actually the biggest gain is interesting. It's between 5 and 20 millivolt. That's here. Below 5 millivolt, the really cold neutrons, that's death as a function of height. And the thermal neutrons, which do not have this effect that I showed at the surface, they are also significantly enhanced. Mostly, we are not sure we know everything, but mostly, probably the biggest factor are these two, that we remove less, smaller volume of moderators. And that just shows that if we have a moderator like that, the neutrons come out, here a flat moderator, and then you look at the angular distribution, if it will be oriented, there's a preference directional that by the shape of the moderator. Now that was also kind of a graph for decades, how to make the neutrons come out in one direction out of this million which we don't use, ask them to come out in one direction more than the other. We never managed to do it by nuclear physics, but the shape of the moderator at the end produces some anisotropy, and this is what we gain. And that's the end of result of using the summary of this moderator. Here's the moderator, the bispectral and flat moderator used at ESS for all beams are bispectral in a very large angle, 240 degree excess angle. The conventional moderators before GPAC, everybody built that for cold moderator, which is just a flat moderator by looking in the wrong surface. The volume moderator, parahydrogen introduced by GPAC, would give us ESS. This kind of brightness, and if we go to not even optima, we still could go further, but we went sort of conservative 3 centimeter high moderator, just turning this moderator around and making it parahydrogen, mixture with parahydrogen, we get that much here. And the gain in the thermal neutron range is also considerable. Now, so what people were worried about, how the fast neutron background is affected by that, and here I show the distribution as a function of height of different moderators for core neutrons, for thermal neutrons, 50 millivolt, but if you go to faster neutrons, then you start to see the effect that they are congregating around the surface of the moderator and the fast neutrons too. But if you do noise to signal ratio is actually for the small moderator is better because the signal went up, but the background didn't go up that much. It also went up, but much less. So that's also a way to have reduced the background. It's just to remind you, we had another study. If we would use that at the ILL, instead of that, we would get fluxes like that. This is the ILL D2 moderator. Conventional H2 moderator would do that at the ILL. And this H2 moderators with modern design, low-dimensional design, give that. So it works for reactors also. Then this raises the issue. Basically, we are talking about brightness. You have to deliver the neutrons, you are interested not what you have in the source, but what gets to the sample. But for the delivery, which originally was just direct view of the source of light, we have to go back a few hundred years and do the professional thing, the right thing, what the microscope. People who invented the microscope, that's that we have a light source, and we make sure that we focus the beam on the sample, by which, according to Liouville, the only thing that matters is the brightness of the source. because that's a constant of the motion, and you will get on the sample the as many neutrons which correspond to the same brightness, and then the divergence and monochromaticity of the delivery. Interestingly, the first system I know of, the first system which worked in that triple axis machine, which used this deposition as IN20 at ILL, they threw out the big opening to the source, made a small virtual source, that is, the background will be better, and used optics, like the microscope guys, to have more neutrons with a smaller bright area on the sample. It's a very successful machine. So what it means, that we have a source, then we have to have some lens, some optics, and if with this optics we can project the neutrons for a long way, and then we have to collect them to the sample. What we have to respect in the Liouville theorem, that the phase space volumes are the same here and there, that basically the area multiplied by the divergence of extraction cannot be smaller than the area of the sample and the divergence you want to have in the sample. And there are, so instead of taking ordinary guides which have many reflections and they tend to be as big as the moderator or the sample, we have to do some optics. This is very schematic for definition ballistic guide. Here you would have kind of parabolic focusing ends. And if you make the guide cross-section bigger, then the number of reflections is much smaller, because by Liouville, big area means low divergence. So a good, well-designed ballistic guide these days would do very little loss to the neutron flux up to several hundred meters. ESS uses 160 as the longest. Come on. And that just shows some simulation studies in a little bit more detail, that the neutrons on the sample, you don't have to do any Monte Carlo, any calculation. Just assume that your student who does the calculation does it right. Usually more senior people don't do the calculation anymore. So we have a good student. And then this optical beam delivery system, like the ballistic guide, would make sure that on the sample you have the brightness of the source, and then all the parameters, the time, area, wavelength, precision, and solid angle, with one parameter, the transmission efficiency. And if you do a guide right, it has to be at least 60%. I mean, there are a number of calculations. At the end, you got to 60%. And this is an example for a 150-meter guide in two cases. When we have a small sample, then the Liouville limit would be this, because we don't want a big phase space at the end, at the sample. If you have a big sample, the Liouville limit is this line, because if the moderator is too small, then it doesn't have the phase space you want on the other end at the sample end, and then this is the theoretical maximum for the blue one. And here you see you can get to 60% kind of efficiency. Conventional guides would do for both sample size that much. Now, I will not spend time on this, I just put it into the calculation, that if we go through all that, what we come to the conclusion, in terms of thinking of the instrument, that the peak flux is what determines performance, assuming the pulse is sufficiently long for your application. If we want to do small angle scattering, we need rather long pulses so that the wavelength definition should be not better than 10%. But otherwise, we lose intensity on the excessive resolution. If we want to do good resolution diffraction, then the long enough means 100 microseconds. So if we want to have a facility which can serve everybody well, then all pulses have to be long because they are also have higher peak. And then shape them, as I mentioned. And that's to reassure, that's my last slide. The conclusion of that, I come back to this wavelength frame selection by an earlier slide that we have the source pulse or virtual source pulse, then the fast chopper which creates the short pulses, and then we need a number of choppers to make sure that a neutron, which for example comes from here, cannot jump into the next. From here, it cannot escape to the other. And then if you look at the construction of such a chopper system, it comes out that it depends on the opening time of the wall choppers, or the choppers which try to keep them apart. And you have to have these choppers, the chopper goes up, opens slowly, not in 0 microseconds. So you have a certain opening time between fully closed and fully open so they don't interfere with the flux. And the long pulse definition is, a pulse is long if it's about at least 4 times as long as the opening time, that is going from fully closed to fully open, of the choppers you can afford to put up here. And in normal cases, it would be about 0.5 milliseconds, the pulse lengths, the long pulse limit as it comes out. If the pulse is shorter than 0.5 milliseconds, then by doing these tricks, the system will not go with the peak, but by the average over the time, the chopper system looks at the source, but something like average over 0.5 milliseconds. For example, in this Japanese instrument, the DNA, they have the chopper system is such that the repetition, this length, when they look at it, is 0.7 milliseconds. And if you remember, the pulse still had intensity at 0.7. So instead of going to the peak, you remember this peak pulse, I didn't want to go back. And I said the peak pulse has to be, in the peak pulse theorem, replaced by the average over the time, the long minimum long time defined by the chopper system. If you spend more money over a chopper, it will be shorter. Then, for example, ESS, you don't have to worry, we have 2 milliseconds, so these choppers are not very tough. The Japanese made some effort to get the choppers faster, so they can use a short pulse source with pulse shaping. And that's the conclusion, that if thinking of Liouville and all the rest what I was talking about, assume we have a 15 megawatt long pulse reactor, with 10 hertz rep rate and 300 microsecond effective pulse length. These are the numbers I heard. This would give a peak flux of 300 times ILL. And for a number of applications, that will matter. When the pulse length, the 300 microsecond is not too long. So pulse length will be enough for the resolution. Now, when you go to applications where you need, for example, small angle scattering, you would need lesser resolution, then you have to apply this rule that you have to average over the ideal pulse lengths for the resolution. And that, then you don't get So it's given a low wavelength resolution, but like SANS, you will be at 50 or 30, something like that. And actually, for most of the things, all the reparate the spectroscopy cases, in all cases, because there you don't have this. So when you just want to have monochromatic pulses, like a ToF spectrometer, you don't need to worry about that. You can shorten the pulse as you want it. Actually, some short pulse machines already use pulse shaping, at least on the financial sheet. For example, in Los Alamos, there was a machine which should have a short pulse shaping chopper for a time-of-flight machine. And by the time they would have the money to build in the chopper, the facility was shut down, or the lens went out of user operation, so it wasn't done, but it was built several times. So in a small fraction, it's a relatively small fraction of the application, or less than half, much less than half, when you cannot use this number, when the 300 microseconds is not enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Harry. I think we all have been impressed, really, by seeing how much can be done at a long pulse and low repetition rate neutron source just by trickily enough tailoring things like the chopper system, moderator, and so on and so forth. So your talk is now, of course, open for discussion. So please come up with your questions, comments. Oh, yeah.
My question is about multiplexing regime.
Yeah.
For instance, in diffraction, what is real gain factor could be?
Real?
Gain factor.
Diffraction, if the diffraction, the gain factor is that if the pulse is about the minimum, at least at the minimum, that you can build a chopper system, that you always get the peak flux with good wavelengths resolution. So that is, for example, in this case, for diffraction, you will always go with that. If the pulse length is something like 500 microseconds or longer, if it's shorter, you will have to average it. You lose a factor of two. And there's another thing which is important, that these kind of games, in particular when the pulse is shorter, you will really have event recording, which you already have, and random phase slowing. Then the user will not know that the pulse was longer than 20 microseconds. Will not be able to see from the data.
Thanks. Further questions, comments? Yeah, Hartmut, please.
I wonder, what about polarized neutrons? Is it possible to integrate them somehow in the system?
The polarized neutron actually, yes. Polarized neutrons come either polarized by a crystal, that won't work. For the rest, it's not different. If you use super mirrors and the guide coming in, you can do pretty efficient super mirror guides which are polarized. In particular, that if the guide in the center of the guide, when the divergence is reduced, there it's easy to polarize, which was just built in Berlin. The Berlin time of flight machine is now polarized. And the polarizer sits a little bit up. And the other thing is, of course, that there's a lot of progress with analyzers in the helium. Is the helium, for example, Jülich has now huge solid angle helium 3 cells for the analyzer side. So I think it's the same as for continuous, except that you don't have the crystal. And the progress for both is really considerable in the last years.
Thank you. Yeah, Anatoly, once again.
Maybe another question. At ESS, practically all instruments have a very long flight paths. And
not all, yes.
About 160 meters, I guess.
It's less than half, but yes.
Yeah. So it, the reason for this very long flight path.
Now, for this long path, I mean, in some cases, the reason is that people thought that this was more complicated than the long path, than the longer. So this 150 meter comes out such that then you don't, a single pulse fills the whole data collection time. And so that is, instead of having longer guides, they could have that. But on some of the machines use the rep rate multiplication like the Dream diffractometer. But at ESS, the long instruments are often long for conservative reasons, just not making it simpler. But there's another point, that the lower rep rate and the useful wavelength band in the experiment, it cannot be 20 angstrom. So with the rep rate, you have to go to a distance to make sure that you focus, the ESS, the long machines, have a 1.6 angstrom wavelength band for data collection. So if for experiment where you cannot use longer, then the distance is dictated by the wavelength band. And if we go to this magnetic diffractometer, which has half the length, it's basically because they wanted a broader band. And then they use this trick.
Thank you so much. I don't see further questions, so let me thank once again for this fantastic talk.
Thank you. Yes.
And immediately let's proceed, as I announced, with the presentation that was originally that of Viktor Lazarevich Aksionov. It has been now divided into two parts. The first part will be presented by Professor Anatoly Balagurov. So, Anatoly, please.
Okay. So, Viktor Aksionov is co-chairman of so-called sub-working group, which was organized a couple of years ago for completion of strategic long-range plan of our institute. And this presentation is report of Viktor Aksionov about the work which was performed in the last year. Well, this is the list of the members. You see that another co-chairman is Sasha Yoffe, and many members. And you see also that Viktor Aksionov would like to change a little bit this list. First of all, he asks to move him from co-chairman position, from this position to this one. As I understood, he thinks about conflict of interests. And another changes are here. Instead of Dr. Harrison, he proposed Dr. Lopatkin from Dolezhal Institute to be as a member, to act as a member of this working subgroup. You see that Dorota Khudoba is scientific secretary of this group, Jack Carpenter from United States, Norbert Kucherka from Slovakia, Timur Kulevoy from Russia, from Kurchatov Institute, Alexei Lopatkin from Dolezhal Institute, Ferry Mezi from Lund, Pavel Mikula from Nuclear Physics Institute Rzesz, Denis Nagy, you know him, Valery Nisizhevsky from France, from ALL, Laszlo Rosta from Hungary, Stanislav Sidorkin from Institute of Nuclear Research in Troitsk, and
Igor Tretyakov, again from Dolezal Research Institute. Well, here he would like to remember you as what are scientific opportunities with a high neutron flux. Maybe I will not discuss it in details because this transparency was already shown for you at some of the previous PAC meeting. You see that a lot of scientific tasks, including solid condensed matter physics, nuclear physics, irradiation, radiobiology, and so on, so on. Well, here he listed some main parameters of future Dubna neutron source. The most important parameter is, of course, this time averaged neutron flux. Here the number is 2 × 10^14. It is on the level of ESS and 20 times higher than we have now at the IBR2 reactor. Another parameters are listed here. The width of neutron, thermal neutron pulse is around 300 microseconds, frequency 10 hertz. Power background between pulses 2-3 times lower should be at, than we have now. And several types of moderators, different temperature and different geometry. This list of parameters was formed during our discussions in the last year. There were organized several of them, and these parameters were discussed as accessible for many, many applications of neutron scattering. There were published several papers about different options of future neutron source in Dubna. You see that two of them finally were discussed. The first is neutron superbooster, and the second is reactor. As to superbooster, of course, it needs in a proton accelerator, and as proton accelerator, again, several options were discussed. The most real is linear superconducting accelerator with energy of about 1 GeV. There were, and still there are several open questions here listed. First of all, it is accelerator stability, matching of the pulse lengths, and of course the cost. One of the most attractive features of our neutron source, IBR2 reactor, is its perfect stability. You see that during days or even weeks, the power and neutron flux are very, very stable. For spallation neutron sources, at least at existing neutron spallation sources, this picture is absolutely different. Well, as to moderators, we had up to now only very preliminary pictures, and maybe in the next talk of Sasha Yoffe, it would be discussed in more details. Finally, we formed this list of spectrometers as a basic set, as a first set for future neutron source. You see that there are 15 instruments which are distributed between diffraction, inelastic scattering, small angle scattering machines, reflectometers, and neutron radiography. Here you see the main items, main issues for each instrument. for several of them, for these two and for these two, we need high resolution, and of course we need some kind of fast chopper. We would like to use Fourier instrument for diffraction and conventional Fermi chopper or set of choppers with some ideas which were discussed in the previous talk, the Fermi, multiplication and so on, for high resolution instruments. All other instruments instead of these four do not need high resolution and pulse lengths of about 300 microseconds is absolutely adequate for them. Also, you see several types of moderators and several, well, really two types of different geometries. And here are conclusions of Viktor Aksionov. So during last year, we discussed two proposals, pulsed fast reactor with, we propose to call it as IBER 3. The cost of this instrument machine would be about 200 million euro. Or accelerator-based neutron source with plutonium. Here it is neptunium. Proposed to use. Here, plutonium cost could be several times higher. Open questions, stability of accelerator. And if we will use the second option, accelerator-based neutron source, of course, we need some more arguments for how can we use this accelerator for some other new scientific problems, nuclear physics, biophysics, medical applications, and so on. So for this year, 2019, the main task for discussion is moderators and spectrometer optimization. And the last conclusion is that today we have a good justification of instruments for lone pulse source. Lone pulse here means about 300 microseconds. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anatoly. I would like to invite right now Sasha Elfe to continue with the presentation and would like to suggest to have a discussion together afterwards.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a report about the progress which is made in the working group. What Anatoly has already introduced. So, okay. So this is just a group. How it is? He just talked about it, so skip it. But you can only you can see that it's staffed by people from physics, from different countries, from different kind of physics, fundamental physics, solid state physics. Also, very important with people from accelerators and people from the NICAD, who are just evaluating things. Sorry. So, how the group activities are built? So, the first meeting of the group happened half a year ago, just in June, after the PAC meeting. And already in December, the first workshop of advanced ideas and experiments for Dubny Neutron Source 4. The names are changed continuously, but it's for the moment it's like this. It was held here in this room in the beginning of the December. And yesterday we had already the second meeting of working group, and we were working in the directions how the neutrons are going from source to moderators, from moderators to neutron guides, and from neutron guides to the instruments. These are four main areas which are covered by the work of the group. And today what we have some kind of basic parameters defined, what already was also mentioned. So we're coming for the moment from the point that maximum allowable thermal power will be about 10-15 megawatt. This, according to Evgeny Pavlovich Shabalin, kind of political request, hardly will be allowable more. It means that mean neutron flux, what we can achieve, it's 10 to the 14 neutrons per square centimeters, which is not bad. It corresponds to the mean flux of the most world-leading pulse source. If we're now looking for the structure of the pulse and compare it to the other one, you can see this is what Ferry-Mezis just showed, the pulse from ESS, long pulse, which is about 3 milliseconds. Here's the pulses of another sources. And this is pulse of the IBA2 today. See, it has quite high brilliance, and but so, certainly much not so white as pulse from the ESS. But new one is supposed to be 20 times more than today pulse of the IBA2. So it means that with integral, this pulse will be more or less integral to this pulse, and we have the source, which is of ESS class, so the highest possible for today neutron flux. So we have today two concepts, two alternative approach how to build such source. One of them, Anatoly already mentioned, this is a super booster. It was the initial idea to have the pulse reactor where we have the core and periodically rotating wheel. And in this case, the proton beam is coming under to shape and ignite the reaction, which is situations under critical. And then they come in together when the opening of the wheel come in here and the reactor started to work. And the multiplication is going up, and this moment the proton beam is coming also. So this is also a booster technology. And another idea was just different. This is more or less ESS-like idea. When we have accelerator-driven neutron source, we have the rotating tungsten wheel, the spallation reaction from the proton beam, when neutrons produced here, but then these neutrons are multiplied. So you can see this is kind of ESS design, but surrounded by the multiplication core. In this case, suggested plutonium dioxide core. And this is two, as I mentioned already, ideas which we're discussing now. So as you remember such picture, which was shown by Viktor Aksyonov and Evgeny Shabalin, so this is HOS, which was decided where to go, and Kostot, where to go the way of booster. I don't know why they put this crow here, but in a way, but crow made the job. Crow thought, accelerator may have instabilities. And after this, it was really figured out, and this is actually the very important result of the work on the group showing the work is really working, that some instabilities of the reactor, which Anatoly just mentioned, when the reactor operation is stopped, and this is unfortunately inevitable for today, can stop for a couple of seconds only, we have a very undesirable effect of the cooling, continuous cooling of the fuel assembly, which results in the increase of reactivity of reactor core. And after this accelerator is rising up power, we get an increase in the power, which is not tolerable. What one can't tolerate is about factor of 3 here increase, and you can see, dependent on the multiplication of stabilities factor of our assembly, it can even rise more or less, let's say, exponentially. So reactor in this case will immediately shut it down, and then we have to restart it after days. So this is not a way how the operation can go. Therefore, the idea, one can decrease the multiplication factor, but we require increase of the energy of the protons. We go to, then, this case, to ESS-like accelerator, and which certainly could cost quite a lot of money. So this idea was given up, and from Superbooster, they suggested to go to a design which called IBA3. It means the same kind of like IBA2, but to increase power to 10 megawatt with frequency repetition rate 10 hertz, and the same pulse length as today, which means that we have the long pulse source, but surrounded by neptunium core. And in this case, it's for purpose to have it more or less spherical and to reduce the amount of neptunium inside, it will be designed in such a smart way. But still the same neutron flux is expected. So the next step, what we did, we went to moderators, and Sergei Kulikov made a number of evaluations about it. It's not working, about. Okay, thank you. So, and this was already the first Monte Carlo, MCNP calculations what we made. This is kind of visible assembly. This is the reactor core, this is a rotating view. It was made for an IBA2 reactor in this case. And this, they are, this blue one, they are water moderator, sorry, this light blue, they're water moderators. And here we have also the cold moderators around it. And he evaluated the flux which can be around it, and the, which goes for the, some, this cold, fast Newton ratio. This, so you can see that it's quite a nice fluxes, which you have, see, okay, you have one direction, so the flux will be less, and another direction, flux will be high. So I just wanted to say that this process already started, and we just already on the, go, on the right way. So Newton instruments, Anatoly just mentioned it already in this, shortly, and I also to add some things. For today, we considered about two basic types of the instrument for diffraction: inelastic scattering, small-angle scattering, reflectometry for study large-scale structures, and also for Newton imaging. And these are main experimental techniques which are used. It does not mean this exclusive; it can be more. But for the moment, we started from this like a baseline. So, if we look for the requirements for different instruments, we can specify them. Okay, we have different spectrum which is allowed, and instruments for diffraction are more or less here. Instruments for spectroscopy is over here. For large-scale structure studies, it's going to the cold area. Fundamental physics required something which is very cold and outer cold, and imaging stays somewhere in between. And this is area of our interest. But if we look from the point of view of divergences of the beam, then we can classify this instrument for instruments which are intensity hungry, but can accept quite large divergence because the Q resolution is not tremendously requested. And from other side, we have instruments which require very high angular or Q resolution, and they, we call them, let's say, brilliance hungry instrument. In this case, we can see that we need two different kinds of moderators. In one case, we need instruments with increased brilliance, which was just shown by Ferry Mezis, this development of the ESS, where we can increase the brilliance by a factor of three by using the flat moderators with reduced height, let's say, reduce size, and this can be conventional moderator, which when we need more neutrons and needs also need more intensity. So this is how we can consider for the moment the directions for studies of moderators. So about the pulse length, it also was analyzed, and this is a slide which is taken from ESS team. So you see that what is accepted or desirable by different instrumentation. So it's for a radiation walk, it does not matter, or it can be a continuous one. For small angle scattering, spin echo, reflectometry, and imaging, it should be quite long pulse. For diffraction and spectroscopy, the pulse should be short, but principally with different techniques can go to a longer one. And this is another thing. So principally, we can say from this point of view that we can find, and this is our task for future, we have to find optimal conditions for all instruments, trying to overlap them and to come to final conclusion what is the pulse length is desirable for us. Is this 300 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds what we're talking about? So this is the task for the next year, let's say. And but just wanted to say this comment again that what Ferry in a way illustrated in his talk, that sufficiently long pulse allowed you to get more intensity or avoid any intensity losses because you have excessive resolution. So one thing what I wanted to add more, that it was a discussion last time in PEC, that problem of delayed neutrons. This certainly is a problem with such kind of reactors. When you have the problem is that from the core, delayed neutrons, which are absolutely essential for the operation and the control of the reactor assembly, they also, and they're coming, they're delayed with on seconds, 2-3 seconds, for example, and they come into the moderator and getting thermalized like conventional neutrons, and they're going on the top of the going on the top of the reactor spectrum. It means you can consider such a reactor like pulse reactor. Like this is like a reactor which producing pulses, and this is this delayed neutrons. It's more or less the steady power reactor, which is, has smaller power, which about percent of peak flux or average power, better to say, but they are here. And they are very essential, these neutrons, because they come in everywhere. This is providing background. In this background, we're terribly afraid of. And one knows for the, with the work with IBA2 today that this background is very important and really limiting the performance of some instruments. Clear way out of it will be to put some kind of choppers somewhere which will reduce the time when this background is visible by our instruments, such kind of chopper window. And suggestion was For example, to have such a situation when you have one background chopper, let's call it, on some distance at 5 meters, that means behind the score, and we try to demonstrate that it will allow us to get the pulse here. In this case, the resolution certainly will be spoiled, but if for purposes of low machines which requires low Q resolution, like small angle scattering reflectometry, it's not really matter because we have already excessive resolution with 200 microseconds. So if we go now with pulse which is broader, in this case a few milliseconds pulse, about 2 millisecond pulse, then we're getting these neutrons are no more the background, they are now the part of pulse. So we will not spoil our things. And this is demonstrated our quick simulations, which were made already here in ONF by Valentin Sadilov and Viktor Bodnarchuk. So this is a reflectivity from 500 angstrom aluminium layer on silicon substrate. If we will work without such a chopper, our level of visibility will be somewhere here. Everything here will be smoothed and disappeared. That will be background. But such a simple chopper assembly already allows us to get down to level 10 to the minus 6 and further on. And principally, one can use here double or triple windows here. It will require certainly more frame overlap choppers. This has to be analyzed further on. But in this case, it will be some kind of system what Ferry Mezzi just discussed. So this is, means that we don't have a real problem for with background. We can solve the problem also. So now just some kind of recommendations, which we had this international workshop here. And these recommendations, we came here, we'll not probably read everything through, but important part is that we would like to cooperate further with NICIET, with the chief designer of reactors, and the work of two conceptual, two possibilities for DNS4. It's pulse periodic reactor RB3 or proton accelerator driven source with multiplying target. So when we defined more or less the pulse duration, like a range, it can be with such a repetition rate, which as mentioned already can be shifted, but it's sufficient for discussions with reactor builders. And we have to make as a provision to put choppers to suppress background, which I showed you in the previous slide. Another recommendation is that we have to make certain cost estimates already of experimental stations. This should be made on the basis of the real labor costs here, not just taken automatically how it costs at the ESS, because we know that there is a difference. And we have to consider, we develop the concept of neutron moderators, and this we see now like a primary task for 2019, because they have to be coupled with the design of the reactor. And also there is a proposal to to develop ultra-cold and very-cold neutron factory, which is kind of history in Dubna. There are a number of good ideas about it and can definitely enrich the science case. So, and this is our conclusions, which I will not repeat, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, I mean, to both speakers. The presentations are now open for questions and discussion. May I put immediately a very provocative question, which I would like to say should not be answered right now in full detail, because that will be obviously
should not be
answered in full detail because that would be premature, and it will be of course the conclusion of the working subgroups. But nevertheless, in view of all the needs that right now can be seen from the instrument side. This is in a way a replacement for an overall scientific case. Can we bring any arguments right now, apart from, I would say, exotic applications like backscattering spectroscopy and so forth, for a solution based on an accelerator-driven neutron source, or unless there is another justification for the accelerator, of course, medical applications and so on. Okay.
I didn't full stop. Resolution or repetition?
No. Is there any justification, an obvious justification right now for an
accelerator-driven
solution? Mm-hmm. Or can we say that actually all the needs what we right now see can be also solved by IBR3.
So, I think I will take an option not to answer. As I thought, I shouldn't answer, but I can only comment my, more or less my private point of view in this case. I think both of these approaches are quite productive. We don't know how it will work in the end. It can be kind of underwater stones. One was found, can be another will be found. We don't know. Both of ways, in my understanding, are quite straightforward now, because in one case we have a situation like ESS one, and this is looks like attractive because you have ESS with a kind of multipline assembly on top of it, and this can be done actually only here, it's clearly. IBUS 3 is also a very nice situation, and we have more or less the same parameters of the end. I think the final answer will be done by reactor designers who can tell us at first, is it feasible, not feasible, what kind of underwater stones they see over there. Can be plenty of details, caused with cooling and so on, and we're now discussing with them. So, as it was mentioned by Anatoly, the first project, the IBUR 3, is already under considerations, and I think in 3 or 4 months they will start to consider the second project, so we'll have a result more or less till the end of the year. And till this moment, I would avoid to comment on this further.
Thank you very much. That I haven't expected more than that, of course. So, further comments, questions? Yeah, of course, yeah, Boris.
Could you please once again list the reasons, rationally, for the use of the neptunium in IBUR 3? Because in IBUR 2 we don't use neptunium.
I think this case it would be more suitable if this answer were answered by Evgeny Pavlovich Shabalin, because it's his idea and it would be just a better interpreter. Can you just do it? Do you have microphone, please? What's his microphone?
Sorry. I should say that neptunium has much advantages about plutonium fuel. First is very low lifetime, neutron lifetime in the core. The second is a good opportunity to modulate the reactivity. And the third one is due to fuel to burn up, we will have no reactivity effect. So the neptunium core will in operation for 20 or more years without replacement the fuel. What is the most important advantage of neptunium?
Please.
After this explanation, I have just symmetrical question. Why the plutonium is suggested for another option?
So now I have to give to another guy in this case, to be symmetric in this case. Yuri Nikolaevich, can you say it? But take microphone, please. Somebody of you, at least.
По-русски, можно?
Okay.
Но если говорить о требованиях, которые мы предъявляем к источнику по плотности потока нейтронов, то наилучший материал для источника нейтронов, предназначенный для работы на выведенных нейтронных пучках, это плутоний. В любом случае, в идеальных расчетах и практических расчетах, плутоний лучше нептуния по плотности потока 4-5 раз. Никогда на Нептунии мы не можем получить такие потоки, как на Плутоне.
Ну, давайте на этом остановимся.
Это вот первое.
Переведи. Ferry, should I translate it for you or for others? Okay, the statement was that plutonium is more suitable material to get higher neutron fluxes than neptunium. So potentially, from plutonium we can get more neutrons than from neptunium. This is what I would say in this case. Was another question I saw somebody. Pavel? Yeah. Айсонова, okay, but it's... Just Mikova, sure.
There were the estimate costs difference about four, factor of four between these two versions. The cheaper one was without the accelerator or the with the accelerator?
So this is complicated for the moment to answer because the cost evaluation I saw today in the report of Aksyonov, 200 million, it's different what we saw yesterday in Shabanin, which was close to 500 million. And about the price of the another option, I think here the margin is quite wide. We don't know how much accelerator will cost. Accelerator is kind of a known parameter for the moment. A known parameter from the point of view who can build it, how to build it. But we're talking about something that will be 20 years. So to say today something is possible, something is impossible, it will be quite risky.
So thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to proceed because we are very, very much beyond our schedule. So thank you once again, and this procedure will be continued anyway. So let me invite now the first speaker of the scientific presentations, Dr. Kizma, structure and property, Kizma. Structure and properties of aqueous solutions of fullerene and C60 and C70 fullerenes for biological applications. So the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. So today my presentation is devoted to the structure investigation of fullerene solution for biomedical application. This work... Okay. This work is an example of effective collaboration between different scientific groups. So fullerene water solution prepared by solvent exchange method were provided by our colleagues from Moscow State University and Kyiv National University. Structure characterization was done with help of our colleagues from our laboratory and from Helmholtz-Zentrum Hirschach in Germany, Kyiv National University in Ukraine, Wigner Research Center in Hungary, and Institute of Experimental Physics in Slovakia. Some in vitro biological experiments were carried out in a laboratory of radiation biology in our institute and in Petersburg's Nuclear Physics Institute in Gatchina, and in vivo anti-tumor experiments were done in Kyiv National University. In the beginning of my presentation, I will say about fullerene properties in different solutions, then some results of the structure investigation of the initial fullerene water solution as well as its complexes with anti-tumor drugs will be presented. Of course, our neutron investigation was accompanied by biological tests, and some results of these biological tests will be presented too. And afterwards, I want to say some words about fullerene prospects in the therapy of neurodegenerative diseases. So, fullerene is a new allotropic state of carbon. In contrast to graphite or diamond, fullerene can be solved in a wide range of organic solvents, which it makes it very promising for different applications. Including biology and medicine, especially taking into account that fullerenes have very good antioxidant properties. But fullerenes form a stable solution only in low polar solvents. Fullerene solution in polar solvents like pyridine or N-methylpyrrolidine are characterized by cluster formation with time and low solubility. And fullerene is a hydrophobic molecule, which it limits bioavailability. Nevertheless, during the last 20 years, different methods to preparation of fullerene water solution have been found. Fullerene transfer into water via solubilization always helps the covalent modifications. But modification of fullerene surface leads to the limitation of fullerene biological activity. So another method to preparation to obtain the non-modified fullerene water solution was also developed, In this method, non-polatoluene was used as a primary solvent. So fullerene was dissolved in toluene, and then with help of ultrasound, transferred into water. Finally, we obtained fullerene water solution with fullerene aggregate size about 100 nanometers. And nowadays, this fullerene water solution, I mean solution which was prepared by the solvent exchange method, is the most promising for biomedical applications. Nevertheless, for better membranotropic properties, it is necessary to reduce the fullerene aggregate size. This challenge can be successfully resolved by using the new type of the stabilization of the fullerene aggregates in water. For example, due to complexation between C60 and molecules of the primary solvents. And for this purpose, we use N-methylparalidone, where C60 forms stable complexes with N-methylparalidone molecules. And this complexation is responsible for the stabilization of fullerene aggregates and leads to the change of fullerene solubility in water. So, as I mentioned about C60, fullerene solution in polar solvent N-methylparalidone is characterized by cluster forms with time, and water addition to this system leads to the cluster decomposition. Moreover, the fullerene aggregate size in the final system increases with the age of the initial C60 N-methylparalidone solution. In fact, in this way, it is possible to regulate fullerene aggregate size in the final water solution that we can obtain by huge dilution by water of the initial C60 N-methylparalidone solution. It should be noted that N-methylparalidone is moderate toxic solvent, and nowadays it is used in medicine. So as a result, such a fullerene water solution was obtained, and from small angle Newton scattering, we can conclude that in this case, fullerene forms branched clay aggregates with small size up to 30 nanometers. So method of regulation of the fullerene aggregate size in water was developed, and as a result, we obtained fullerene water solution with smaller sizes. The next step of our investigation, it was comparison structure characteristic of the fullerene water solution which was obtained by different method. And as I mentioned above, fullerene water solution based on N-methylparalidone is characterized by formation of the branch clusters with the size about up to 30 nanometers. And in the same time, the fullerenes in the solution prepared by popular solvent exchange method forms big dense packet clusters with size up to 150 nanometers. The mechanism of the stabilization of the aggregate stabilization in this solution is different. In the first case, complexation between C60 and molecules of the primary solvent N-methylparalidone is responsible to the aggregate stabilization. In the second one, fullerene surface gidepsilation is responsible to the aggregate stabilization according to infrared spectroscopy. And also, of course, for biomedical application, fullerene water solution must be stable with time at temperature increasing and in the physiological solution. So all these tests were done. And as a conclusion, the cluster formation under various conditions, temperature, ionic stretch, pH, in aqua colloidal solution of fullerenes were described in detail, and also cluster stabilization mechanism was identified. About fullerene basis anti-tumor complexes. It is well known that chemotherapy is the general principle of tumor treatments, despite numerous side effects, and to reduce the toxic effects of the widespread anti-tumor drugs, several pharmacologic agents, for example, antioxidant or nanoparticles were used. So the two combinations, the widespread anti-tumor drugs with nanoparticles, we can obtain so-called prodrugs with better anti-tumor action and with lower toxicity. And we tested fluorine water solution with six different anti-tumor drugs. Three of them are presented, and we reveal an increase of cluster size at addition of anti-tumor drugs to the fluorine water initial to fluorine water solution for all samples. Moreover, ultraviolet and visible spectroscopy and quantum mechanical computation indicates that fullerenes form stable complexes with anti-tumor drugs. So for all mixtures, the formation of stable complexes will provide, and the complexation leads to significant changes in the cluster states of the initial fullerene solutions. Of course, our structure investigation was accompanied by biological tests, and first of all, it was in vitro cytotoxicity tests of the initial fluorine water solution. It should be noted that last time, correlation between cluster size and the toxicity properties of this solution is actively discussed because it is well known that binding of a membrane receptor strongly depends on the size of the used nanoparticles. So from cell viability tests, which we conduct on mammalian fibroblasts of Chinese hamster, we have compared cytotoxicity properties of the fullerene solution with different, about three times, aggregate size range. And as you can see, survival rate for all samples is more than 80%, and it was in control level. So low toxicity of all fullerene solution under study was detected, and cluster growth does not impair the toxicity of the solutions. After structure investigation, the anti-tumor action were tested on tumor-bearing mice, and some results for the anti-tumor widespread anti-tumor drugs doxorubicin are presented. So it was found that treatment of tumor by doxorubicin with T60 leads to increased enhancement of anti-tumor action of doxorubicin by compared with such effect when doxorubicin or T60 is used alone. As you can see, the results for inhibitor effect and lifespan are presented. Also, it should be noted that the similar results was obtained for all prodrugs under study was obtained. So it was found that prodrugs in a low therapeutic dose enhance the inhibition of tumor growth and lifespan to much higher than than antibiotics alone. I want to say about our last research, which concerning fullerenes in therapy of neurodegenerative diseases. It is well known that unusual protein-protein interaction leads to the formation of amyloid aggregates, which is associated with neurodegenerative diseases as Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's diseases. And nowadays, inhibition or the polymerization of the amyloid aggregation have been decided as a primary therapeutic strategy. For this purpose, different kinds of the nanoparticles were tested as a potential drug, but only magnetic nanoparticles revealed destruction effect. So we tested our fluorine water solution with two model protein fibrils. And as you can see from the results of fluorine intensity, fluorine revealed good depolymerization and inhibition effect, and this result is is in line with atomic force microscopy and small angle neutron scattering, where the decreasing of neutron scattering indicates about indicates to reduction of amyloid aggregates. Also, it should be noted that for the fullerene water solution system based on N-methylpyrrolidin, poor N-methylpyrrolidin was also tested, and as you can see, N-methylpyrrolidin has no effect on the amyloid aggregates. So this inhibition and depolymerization effect relates only with fullerene action. So fullerene solution inhibit formation of insulin fibrils, it's a model system, and destroy amyloid aggregates. Poor N-methylpyrrolidin has no effect on amyloid aggregates. And some conclusion, the cluster formation and various conditions in fullerene water solution are described in detail. A new fullerene water solution with low toxicity was synthesized, and the fine complexation and fullerenes with anti-tumor drugs, as well as destroying effects on amyloid fibrils, indicate that fullerenes are prominent anti-tumor and anti-amyloid agents. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this nice talk, and also for having saved us some time. The talk is now open for questions and discussion. Yes, please.
Okay. First, thanks for the clear and interesting presentations. I have just two curiosities to ask you. The first one is if you evaluated also the possibility to use polyvinylpyrrolidone, that is the oligomer, polymer, then the monomer and methylpyrrolidone. Because moving from small molecules to an oligomer, maybe you can easily tune the dimensions of the aggregates. This is just a suggestion, so I don't know if you evaluate that. The second point is if you have data about the kinetic releasing of the drug from the fullerene aggregates, I don't know, it's for example by APLC analysis. And finally, if you evaluate the possibility to use a confocal microscopy analysis to locate it fullerene inside the cell, just to understand if fullerene is compartmentalized in the cytoplasm or if it is included in the membranes or so on.
Thank you. Yes. So, for questions, we don't use oligomers or polymers. N-methylpyrrolidine is organic solvent. So we don't use oligomers or polymers. And the second question about... I forgot.
The second question was about
from the results of our biological groups, I can say that fullerene safe drugs in the aggressive medium in the blood, and we have effect that anti-tumor drugs with fullerene have another distribution in the cells, in the body cells, in the tumor cells. So with AT60, anti-tumor drugs better accumulated in the tumor. And of course, our biological colleagues used confocal microscope for investigation how the 60 and anti-tumor drugs penetrate to the cells.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to proceed, so thank the speaker once again. And let me invite the next speaker, Dr. Dushanov. Structure and functional properties of mutant NMDA synaptic receptors. So the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, OVT. It's work. The series of biological, radiobiological topic. Just some words about the problem. We here developed some various kinds of study biological structures for neurodegenerative diseases as well as after exposure to ionizing radiation. Aim of this work was developed a computation approach capable to establish a link between mutations in genetic structures and high-level observable properties of neural tissue. So, other thing is I will pass. Yes, we look some biological objects at artificial form. If you know that there are today many structures considered for study of brain, study of cell contacts, synapse contacts in brain, for example, this axon neuron cell with axon and dendrites. Here you can see any contacts may be stable or unstable. we just transform this form to the artificial form and modeling it. excuse me. This is some details of these contacts. Maybe you know about it. Axon terminals contacted via synapses to dendrites via axon, dendrite. In nature, the cells are free and every time search which another. Some contacts are after finding it, some contacts are stable, another may be unstable. And after contact forming, here we can the vesicles comes to terminal and drop their transmitter into the synaptic space. And next work here the receptors on the on the membrane. For example, here I show the NMDA receptor with gating mechanism here, and next gating mechanism in detail. Here are two subunits of NMDA receptor are shown. First is NR1, that for that responsible is gene green one gene, and next subunit is NR2. For that answerable the gene green 2B A other. Here are some transmitters. About them I talk some lately. Here are gating position. Here are some blocking objects, maybe some magnesium and other elements for closed offices. Indeed, this receptor is by structure is tetramer. They are asymmetrically in arginine, NR1 and NR2. Next is after we take one of subunit of this receptor, for example, NR2, and study of some of more missing mutations on this. In here I wrote a sum of four and description with phenotypes and consequences, and we prepare the system with these mutations. First we chose the native form, and next is 540 mutation, and 615, 618, their combination, not bringing it here, and one deletion, if you see. take place molecular dynamics simulation. Here are some words about what we prepared the system to simulation. Some utilities from this package and other for reconstructing of system. Anyway, we used the structure from crystal structure database. And one can I can see here the structure of NMD one more time. This have three clearly domains, one of transmembrane, ligand binding and aminoterminated domains, and paid more attention to this domain that consists is 2D and D2 parts that work in time of activation like a mouse sketching. You can see here on schematic view. And here some dynamics, maybe it not work. Yes. I have some animation, but it not work. It's not a problem. This during the simulation, we get some structure here, and it's begin to opening after finishing. We get the structure with opening of this part, some gating, and. For the structures with mutations and deletion, we consider they are compiled. Black is without native form of receptor. Here some schematic view of the opening inner pore here. And localize it here some mutations, and all characteristics of this simulation results and connection of the mutations is described here. I can say that the deletion is resulted in the poorest opening of the channel among the rest studied mutations, and we calculated all parameters from this simulation to develop of our model. Here, more important the thing is the magnesium binding to other protein, in particular to asparagine molecule with fusion. As you see, the magnesium looks like a spider with six legs or hands. Here are some parameters connected with the magnesium. For example, NM, number of ions that reach binding site, and bound Mg ions, and other. More important other parameters is the connection with conductivity of poor ionic channel. And next is we begin develop another our model with. It may be connected with synchrony and asynchrony behavior of the connected neuronal cells. They give us some rhythms. They call it delta, theta, alpha, beta, or gamma with field there. Region of frequency. Anyway, this more this is a hippocampus. They are more concentrated in the CA part of the hippocampus of brain, and this part more we can observe the two type of waves, gamma and theta. And our schema for the model of all functionality of the this part, so CA3 of hippocampus. Just here can you can see that two types of interneuronal cells and one type of pyramidal cell with three type of receptor. One of we are modeling and change it for other receptors parameters, choose it from literature. And this is our model where for NMDA receptor current we choose this type of model with our parameters from simulation, molecular dynamic simulation, and the solution of this model is looked like this with for basket is spike coordinates and interneurons for pyramidal neurons. It's some difficult, but we easily transform by Fourier to the local photopotential this solution after normalizing, we get power spectrum of this solution. And here you can see some power local field potentials for native. The system with native NMDA with other mutations and deletion one. So we can look for difference of the form and here some am I misprint? I'm sorry. Here maybe all beginning from theta, alpha, beta, and gamma here. Theta, alpha, beta, and gamma regions for one type of another type of mutations and deletion in NMDA receptor. And so, okay. Conclusions here, I can some read, but it is some, you can see. Okay. I can stay in second one, dominant effect of missing mutations of 540, 615, and 689. In green 2B Jenny product was found is reducing magnesium binding ion to ion channel pore and removing conductivity block. In agreement to previous studies, block removal was observed to be maximal in the this mutation and minimal in this. And in contrast, deletion, this type of deletion resulted in significant magnesium block removal, but produced strong disease of channel conductivity instead. And the next is proposed approach can be further extended to for analysis of other synaptic receptor mutations and evolution of possible cognitive impairment following radiated disease and consequence of radiation and other negative factors. This some type of reports are made in some conferences, so one of the international, and two works are published. And this work particularly supported with two type of Russian fundamental science grant. Thank you.
Thank you very much. However, since we have used much more time than originally scheduled, unless there are very, very urgent questions, which does not seem to be the case, thank you once again. I would suggest that we proceed to the next one. The next talk and the last of these scientific reports will be given by Dr. Ivantsov, CPT study of the Fermi surface reconstruction in the TG model. So the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for invitation to this conference. Not maybe not conference, but today I will tell you about cluster perturbation study of the Fermi surface reconstruction in the TG model. So this work was done with collaborating with my supervisor Evgeny Kochetov and with our collaborator Professor Ferraz from Brazil, from International Institute of Physics. Okay. the topic of our investigation is cuprates. So I think all of you knows that this is really a famous family of the compounds, and the most interesting properties is of course high temperature superconductivity, which can be achieved in the really high temperature. But today we today we will discuss some other properties. So it's properties of the normal states of the cuprates, which is also really interesting, and it's still not clear what's the reason of this behavior. So this is so it's not marked on the phase diagram. So this phase is also known on the pseudogap phase, which corresponds to the Fermi surface, which is disconnected Fermi arc instead of Fermi liquid like Fermi surface, which is correspond to the to the metal phase, to the Fermi liquid. So, and at the doping level below about 20%, the Fermi surface is arc which is disconnected, and in this case the quantum oscillation cannot be observed in this doping regime due to behavior of the Fermi surface. So it can be seen on this Fermi surface that it's really so. Now it's supposed that it's the redistribution of the spectral weight on the one side of the some closed surface, but it's also still not clear. There are two interesting things about cuprates. So first of all is the charge ordering, which was discovered in the 2007, I suppose. So due to STM experiments and X-ray diffraction and neutron magnetic resonance experiment, it has been revealed that the electron is distributed not inhomogeneous. So there are some charge ordering. So it's a bidirectional charge density wave in Itribari cuprum oxide and lantan strontium cuprum oxide. So and this charge density wave have a wavelength about 3 or 4 lattice spacing, and this phase can be achieved at the doping level from 8% to 16%. Second one is the presence of the quantum oscillation in this compounds, and it's really an obvious phenomena due to the fact that quantum oscillation imply a closed Fermi surface, and it's well known that the pseudo gap correspond to the disconnected Fermi arc, which cannot produce some quantum oscillation. And this contradiction is really interesting because physicists like really love contradictions. And quantum oscillation can be obtained in the high magnetic field, while the other experimental data, so RPS measurement, STM, can be done only at the zero magnetic field. So the we haven't a full set of experimental data, so we have only a small part of the picture of the full behavior of the cuprates. So, and it's this picture, you can see that quantum oscillation
really exist on only the high magnetic field at the same region, at the exactly same region where the charge ordering is present. So, and this fact allows us to connect these two phenomena to conclude that the one reason leads to both of these. And one more is the quantum oscillation at this region have a small frequency, which implies that the surface of the area of the Fermi surface is small. It's about 4% of the full Brillouin zone. So, in contradiction to the Fermi liquid, Fermi surface race area is really much larger, and area is much bigger. And one more last thing is that the Hall coefficient and Zibig coefficient becomes negative at the low temperature at the same region where the charge density wave is present. So at this picture you can see that at the 8% doping the Zibig coefficient is positive, and with increasing the doping level the Zibig coefficient becomes negative. And this fact is most interesting because this fact implies that at the two points of the doping level, so that in these points, exist some topological change of the Fermi surface. So it's implies that there are some topological transition. A lot of phenomenological theory was put forward to describe this phenomena, but there are one disadvantages of all of this approach. This approach fully neglects the electron-electron interaction. So this approach handle only with the tight bonding model, and to be honest, it's fully one electronic approach. So, but so you can see at this picture that from this approach due to adding the long range ordering theorem to the Hamiltonian, you can achieve some unusual Fermi surface, which is in general corresponding to the experimental observation. But this approach cannot reproduce the crossover from the pseudo gap to the charge density wave phase, and this approach cannot reproduce the topological transition at the Fermi surface. And here I present our model, which we use to describe the cuprates. So it's well known, the TJ model, but we use some unusual approach because we break the translational symmetry in corresponding to the experimentally observation, and we use the exact diagonalization of the cluster 3x3 sites, and we account the intercluster interaction as a tight bonding model. Okay, there are some technical
detail, which I can skip, I suppose. Okay, one thing it should be noted that due to this cluster perturbation theory, we can obtain both the poles of the spectral function and the distribution of the spectral weight at the Fermi level and other. And second thing that due to breaking of the translational symmetry, we can reproduce the inhomogeneous inhomogeneous of the carrier distribution, so of the density of the electrons. So, and due to the fact that we take the 3x3 clusters, it's really close to experimentally observed in the cuprates wavelengths of the charge density wave, which is about 0.31. And we have wavelengths about 1/3. Result of our calculation is results of our calculation is really in good agreement with the experimental observation. So at the doping level, about 8%, we have a hole pocket, which correspond to the pseudogap phase, which also have only hole carriers. And at the following increase doping level, we have a change of topology of the Fermi surface, which accompanied by divergence of the effective mass of the carriers. And following increasing of the doping level leads to the forming of the electron pockets, and next increasing further increasing leads to the emerging of the hole pockets in addition to the electron pocket. So we also calculate the spectral weight distribution of the on the Fermi surface. So this picture is really in good agreement with the pseudogap data, with the RPS data, which also predict the disconnected Fermi arc. And at the increasing of the doping level, you can see that at the boundary of reduced Brillouin zone, which is formed due to the charge density wave, the spectral weight is spectral weight is really becomes small, and further increasing leads to the forming of the some unusual Fermi surface. So yeah, one more time, it's RPS data for the doping level about 10% and 20%, 12% and percent, and our calculation. One more advantages of the our approach is the fact that we account strong electron coloration on the one side, and this leads to the this leads to the forming correct behavior of the Fermi surface in the antinodal region, which in agreement with the pseudogap phenomena should be should have a zero spectral weight at this region, in contradiction with the tight bonding model approach. And due to the charge density wave at the boundaries of the reduced Brillouin zone, the strong Coulomb repulsion leads to the gap opening. So this gap is present in the small region.
Sorry, could you please speed up a little bit?
Yeah. Okay. So, Yeah, there are gap in the Fermi surface. So we have electron pocket, we have a hole pocket, and we have gapped region in agreement with this picture. And here we can see the reconstruction of the Fermi surface in the at the various doping level. So we can see that at the doping level below 8%, it's pseudo gap, and following increasing leads to deforming electron pocket. Electron pocket plus two hole pockets, and at the doping level about 20%, it becomes Fermi liquid like. And also we calculate the density of state associated with the different types of carriers, and also we have topological transition at the 8%, topological transition at the 16%, and one more transition at the about 11%. So, in agreement with the experimental observation, which predicts the topological changes. Okay, it's conclusion that we can reproduce the correct behavior of the Fermi surface without including any phenomenological parameters by hand, and only with taking into account the strong Coulomb repulsion. That's all. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for this nice talk. Are there any questions or comments? This does not seem to be the case, so thank you once again. And now we will have an unfortunately quite short coffee break, including the visit of poster presentations. I hope that you had already chance yesterday to have a glance at the posters. Please remember that afterwards you will be, I mean, the PAC members and the external experts who are still here will be invited to vote on the posters. 1, 2, 3. So have a nice coffee time and a quick glance to the best posters.